it please the court, my name is Stephen Gordon. I represent Appellant Jiquireya Apache Nation. In 2000, in the Bayless decisions, the Interior Department upheld the methodology developed by its Minerals Management Service for calculating a major portion price for natural gas extracted from the Jiquireya's reservation during the 11 and a half year period from January 1984 through June 1995 as a measure for determining royalties that would be owed to Jiquireya on that gas. 6.5 years later, in 2007, the agency did an about-face and invalidated the same methodology without even acknowledging the contrary precedent of the Bayless decisions. The announced rationale for this about-face was that the Jiquireya methodology failed to conform with MMS regulations that were published in 1988 and took effect on March 1st, 1988. The agency failed to consider that these 1988 MMS regulations were not even in effect for more than a third of the period in issue, the first 4+ years from January 1984 through February 1988. Now, that failure renders Vastar arbitrary and capricious for two different reasons. The first is that it failed entirely to consider an important aspect of the problem before it. The second is that it failed to provide any reasoned explanation for its change in course. The third problem, because we are talking about an Indian tribe, the agency has a fiduciary obligation to adopt the reasonable interpretation of its regulations that is most favorable to the tribe. And here, the agency changed course from a 2000 interpretation that resulted in additional royalties being paid to Jiquireya and instead adopted a different interpretation that precluded them from obtaining additional royalties.
Mr. Gordon, as you know, the government's taking the position that you forfeited much of the substantive argument that you're making. I'm sure you'll turn to that, but I have a preliminary question.
Which, yes, Your Honor.
As to the forfeiture or not, it would seem initially to me that the point you just made about the special treatment accorded a tribe as a litigant does not apply to that. It applies to the substance, the reasonableness of the regulations.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So the forfeiture question is one in which the court has an institutional interest.
Yes.
Okay. Are you going to turn to that anytime soon?
I'll turn to it right now, Your Honor. The appellees argue that this issue wasn't raised below, but in fact, it was flagged at three different points in the motion for summary judgment filed in the district court. It was discussed first in the statement of facts at joint appendix pages 21 to 22, second in the summary of argument at joint appendix 25, and third in the argument itself at joint appendix 28 and 29.
Now, the statement of the argument, which is, I guess, at JA at 30, so that's in your summary judgment motion, I think. It is essentially no more than this, right? The department's stated rationale for overturning the Jiquireya major portion methodology, even if valid, does not apply to the period from January 84 through February 88. That's it, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, now, in our case law, we have many a time faulted a party for not having developed an argument sufficiently for the court to, or for the agency to have evaluated it. Is there anything more to the argument than this one sentence that you would have said had you focused on doing so, or that you want to say now?
Your Honor, obviously there is more that could have been said. The argument that it should have been raised before the agency is specious because Jicarillo was not a party before the agency and could not have become a party before the agency. Second,
yes, I take that, but I'm referring just to the district court proceedings.
Yes, Your Honor. Second, procedurally, what you have is a posture where this was a motion for summary judgment being filed by Jicarillo. There was no cross motion for summary judgment, and what happened was that the court, sua sponte, ruled against Jicarillo without announcing in advance that it was considering that it would do so.
You'd made your case in your motion.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why should the absence of a counter motion be relevant to whether you've made the case adequately?
Well, certain arguments were advanced in support of summary judgment. It is not unusual that you have a quiver of arguments that you make. You may choose to advance only some in your initial motion for summary judgment and reserve others. You may develop some more, you may develop some less. The argument here, in essence, is that because Jicarillo didn't say more about the argument, even though it clearly put it out there, that somehow it's been waived. And I don't read the cases of this court to require that. We, in the case law we've cited, it's that the issue has to be flagged so that it's there for the court to see. And that issue was squarely flagged, and yet the district court, perhaps understandably because the agency hadn't focused on the issue either, the district court didn't focus on it. Could we have said more? Certainly, Your Honor. I can't say otherwise. Did we say enough? Have we forfeited? I disagree, because then how is, at what point do you measure the development of the argument? You know, does it have to be three paragraphs? Does it have to be an entire page? You know, a minor footnote reference might not be sufficient, and there are cases that deal with that. But this argument was touched on three different times in the course of the brief.
Can I ask, the argument that we're talking about is the argument that the 1988 regulations were not the correct regulations.
Yes, right? Your Honor.
And you answered, when Judge Ginsburg asked you, is this the only place, you said yes. I guess I'm seeing this argument in more places than you're giving yourself credit for, and I'm wondering whether I'm misunderstanding. You look at JA 30, which is, I take it, part of your motion for summary judgment, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that paragraph in the middle of the page not entirely devoted to this question?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
So it's not just one sentence, as the government claims, but rather it's a short paragraph, but it is an entire paragraph of the argument.
And that's quoted in our brief, Your Honor.
So I'm not even sure why you're apologizing for only briefly stating it when it's the ultimate paragraph, unless I'm misunderstanding, which is why I'm asking this.
Your Honor, if I've erred in terms of being overly deferential to the court, I apologize.
It's not a question of being deferential to the court. It's conceding a point that you have no reason to concede.
No, I don't think we have a reason to concede it either, Your Honor. We mentioned it and finished with an entire paragraph on it.
Two sentences rather than one.
Well,
they're both quoted in your gray brief at 3.
I think the court has focused on what the discussion is in the brief.
Well, let me just be clear. It's the paragraph that begins in addition.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's three sentences.
Yes, three sentences.
Right? And it's an entire paragraph of your argument, and it's the final paragraph of your argument.
Yes, it is.
Okay. And when you're asked whether there's anything more to be said, what more is there to be said? That is, your argument is they based their decision on regulations that did not apply to the appropriate period.
That's correct.
Is there any more that can be said than that?
Well, you can elaborate on it, I suppose, as much as you like. But once you've said that, you've said it all. I see that, I believe my time...
In your blue brief, you managed to stretch it out to about a page and a quarter, but I must say it doesn't add much to what, what appears at page 30.
I take it you would say that a short argument can sometimes be better than a long argument. And that may apply to this entire argument.
I'll take that as a hint to sit down, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, John Arbab for the Interior Department. Your Honors, the bottom line in this case is twofold. First, the appeal should be dismissed because the sole claim being presented on appeal has been waived or forfeited.
Well, can we pause over that? How can you say that in light of the argument on page 30 of their, JA 30 of their summary judgment motion?
Your Honor, you're correct that this paragraph, this three-sentence paragraph, is the only place in which arguably the claim now being raised was presented to the district court. But the important thing to recognize is that the argument in this paragraph is not actually the claim being advanced on appeal. Even on the most generous reading of this paragraph on JA 30, this is an argument based on the consistency between lease paragraph 3C and the pre-1988 MMS regulations. However, on appeal, the tribe's only claim, or the tribe's sole claim on appeal, has nothing to do with paragraph 3C, or its consistency or non-consistency with any MMS regulations, pre-1988 or the 1988 regulations. So, as stated in the brief at pages 20 through 29, we believe that this is a fairly classic example of an argument that's just too skeletal to count.
I don't understand. Isn't their argument that the Vastar decision, there's two problems with the Vastar decision. One is it does not even mention an identical decision going the exact opposite way, right?
Your Honor, that is not a claim being raised in the Court of Appeals. That was a claim that was raised in the district court.
You don't think they're arguing that point here? Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, in the district court, that claim was made.
Right.
The district court addressed it and rejected it. The district court's ruling is not being challenged here.
So, okay.
I understand that you're saying that this paragraph comes at the end of a discussion of something else, but the statement is nevertheless there that, you know, even if valid, wouldn't apply for this period, which seems to be their argument now.
Your Honor, the argument now, let's be clear, the argument now on appeal is that Vastar applied the 1988 MMS regulations to the initial four-year period of time, January 1984 to February 1988, and that was error, or that was arbitrary and capricious because the 1988 regulations were not in effect then. Now the claim, looking back at the paragraph on JA 30 in the summary judgment motion, that is not the claim being made there. The claim being made in that paragraph has to do with consistency between a provision of the lease, paragraph 3C, and the pre-1988 regulations. It doesn't have anything to do with the notion that regulations are not in effect prior to the date on which the regulations themselves state they will come into effect.
What about the first sentence? The MMS regulations covering the first part of the audit period did not contain the same methodology as the 1988 MMS regulations. And that's true, isn't it?
True, Your Honor, but that doesn't...
And that's their argument today, that for the first part of the audit period, the 1988 MMS regulations didn't apply.
No, it says that they had different provisions. It doesn't say the 1988 regulations were not in effect.
Well, how could it, if it says that the regulations covering the first period did not contain the same requirements as the 1988 MMS regulations, you don't take that as meaning that the 1988 regulations didn't apply during that period?
No, that's not how I read it, Your Honor.
Assume you're wrong. That is, assume I read it that way.
Okay.
If I do, then it's not waived, right? at least in my mind, it wouldn't be waived, right? If that is, if that is an argument that the 1988 regulations didn't apply to the first part of the audit period, then your argument about waiver is not correct.
Well, proceeding on that assumption, Your Honor, yeah, there still would be a serious problem with the summary judgment motion, which is that it did not go on to make any argument whatsoever about why that sentence read that way caused the tribe prejudice.
Well, that's yet a different argument. And now you're getting into the question of whether there was harmless error, right?
Yes.
Well, before we get to that question. Now, your second point was that they're not making the argument that Vastar failed to cite the Bayless decisions and that was arbitrary and capricious, that they're not making that argument in the Court of Appeal.
No, Your Honor, the only claim they're making now is that the 1988 regulations were not in effect during the initial four-year period.
What about page 20 of their blue brief, in which they summarize their argument and they say, further, Vastar is arbitrary and capricious because it fails to provide any reasoned explanation for departing from the agency's precedent in the Bayless decisions.
Your Honor, they're making that argument only with respect to the initial four-year period.
Yeah, well, maybe you're lucky about that. You know, they only want the money for the first four-year period. I wonder why they don't make it for more. Maybe they're entitled to everything. But the fact that they're not stretching it to the entire period doesn't mean that they're not making the argument. Why? There's nothing in that sentence that says that they're not making the argument at all.
Your Honor, you have to read the entirety of their brief.
You can believe me, I've read the entirety of their brief.
The entirety of their brief is an argument based on the initial four-year period.
It is, and there's two problems. I read the brief, and the way I read it is there's two problems with the first four-year period. One, the agency, in a quite unbelievable opinion, does not even, unbelievable in the sense that the agency must know that there is a prior opinion of the agency on exactly the same subject, which goes exactly the opposite way, and the agency doesn't mention it. This is like the definition of arbitrary and capriciousness.
Your Honor, I disagree because it's clear from the Vastar opinion what agency precedent is being overruled.
Really? Do you see either the Bayless opinion or any citation anywhere in Vastar to Bayless?
Your Honor, I grant you that Vastar does not cite Bayless by name, but...
Or by citation, or even by a nod that the agency had previously decided this exact same issue.
Your Honor, to go back to the initial basis of your line of questioning, to the extent that Vastar and Bayless discuss the initial four-year period, both decisions are consistent with each other. As we point out in the brief, Bayless makes the point that lease paragraph 3C was consistent with the pre-1988 regulations. Vastar makes the same point. Lease paragraph 3C is consistent with the pre-1988 regulations. That has nothing to do with whether the Jicarilla methodology is consistent with the pre-1988 regulations. So
Did Bayless uphold the Jicarilla methodology?
Yes, Bayless upheld the Jicarilla methodology.
And did Vastar reverse the...
That's right. Jicarilla. Vastar said, no, we've changed, we, the agency, have changed our minds.
And did Vastar note the fact that in Bayless it had done the opposite?
Did it say we've changed our mind?
Did it say we've changed our mind, even? It's
clear that the agency had changed its mind.
It is clear, but the agency doesn't recognize it. And we have opinion after opinion, which basically says this is the definition of an arbitrary and capricious agency
action. Your Honor, I think that
the failure to say that you're changing your position.
Your Honor, first, this is not the tribe's argument on appeal.
Well,
secondly,
let me say first, I read this as being the tribe's argument.
Okay,
on appeal,
I respectfully disagree. Yeah. Secondly, I don't think you need to look for a statement of the kind that you would like to see. I think the operative administrative law principle is it clear from what the agency has said what the path of its reasoning is? It is clear.
No, but we have there's a whole series of cases, including the Supreme Court's opinion in State Farm, that says when an agency reverses its position, it has to acknowledge that it's doing that and explain why. It can certainly give a good and rational reason, but it has to understand, it has to recognize that it is changing its position.
Your Honor, it couldn't have been clearer that the Interior Department realized in Vastar that it was changing its position in Bayless. The exact same methodology is at issue in both cases.
And why didn't it mention Bayless? Just forgot, or didn't notice it, or what? What's the explanation for the failure to mention Bayless?
I would say that it wasn't necessary because it was so clear that the same methodology that had been approved.
Let me ask you this. If we decide against you today, and we issue an opinion explaining why you're wrong, and tomorrow the exact same case comes up, and we issue an opinion going the exact opposite way, without mentioning the case from today, you don't think that we would be acting in an arbitrary and capricious manner? By not acknowledging that we had done the opposite thing the day before?
I think that in the situation you're posing, it would be implicit in the court's second decision that it was reconsidering and.
But it wouldn't be arbitrary. It may be implicit, but it wouldn't be arbitrary to not even mention it, to not say why you're changing your mind.
If you have different panels, and you wouldn't know whether the latter panel had considered and rejected the position of the prior panel or was ignorant of it, you'd have no way of knowing.
You possibly may not have any way of knowing, but in this situation, it couldn't be clearer that the Vastar panel, so to speak, was.
They're two different people, aren't they?
Yes.
Why is it different than the analogy I just gave?
Well, Your Honor,
two different people, two different panels.
The same methodology was at issue in Vastar as was in Bayless. It was completely clear that the agency in Vastar knew all about Bayless and the fact that it had upheld the methodology then in that decision, and it was changing its mind in the second decision. There's nothing arbitrary and capricious about that.
If you're wrong about this, is there anything left to discuss today?
Well, Your Honor, I still think that there would be an issue about prejudicial error. I mean, the only way that any error in Vastar, whether it's the one Judge Garland has identified or whether it's the one I thought the tribe was presenting on appeal, the only way that prejudicial error occurred is if the Jicarilla methodology was, in fact, valid under the early regulatory scheme.
So your argument is that even if we were to send it back, they would come back and say the same thing because under the earlier regulations, you would come to the same result, right?
Your Honor, it's clear that the agency...
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so you're saying that the agency, if it were to consider those earlier regulations, would come out the same way?
Yes, and it's already clear from what the agency said in Vastar that that's...
Okay, now, there's another, in addition to the number one violation of administrative law we talked about before, there's actually a number one-er, which is the Chenery opinion.
No, Your Honor, I disagree.
Well, Chenery says that we can only uphold on a ground that the agency itself states in its opinion.
Yes.
Now, you're offering a ground that the agency didn't state, namely that it would come out the same way on a regulation that it did not address, right?
No, Your Honor, I'm saying that in all relevant respects, the pre-1988 regulatory scheme is the same as
that's
the
your opinion. The agency didn't say that.
No, that's not my opinion. That's if you compare the text of the of
I understand, but the author of Vastar didn't say what you just told us.
No, but that's a question that the court can answer for itself by looking at the statute.
Under Chenery, that's a question that the court can't answer by itself.
No, Your Honor, the Chenery problem would be if I were offering a way of defending Vastar on grounds that Vastar did not advance.
Right.
But Vastar explained why there are three regulatory failures of the Jicarilla methodology under the 1988 regulations.
But if the author of Vastar was ignorant of the Bayless opinion and were to read it, there's the potential for the author to say, oh, I didn't see that or realize that, right? And so reverse him or herself.
No, Your Honor, I think that the question is, For prejudice to be shown here by the tribe, it has to carry the
burden. It only has to show potential prejudice.
It has to show some reason to think that it was prejudiced.
And well, that it may benefit on remand, basically.
Well, to do that, they have to advance some reason for thinking the outcome on remand would be different. And Vastar has already explained the three failings of the Hickory methodology, which apply equally.
That might be a barrier if the opinion under review had dealt with the contrary decision in Vastar. But not having dealt with it, we have no idea how the agency would view it. That's exactly on point with Chenery. We have no idea how the agency would exercise its discretion.
Your Honor, my argument on this point is that there's not a Chenery problem, because in Vastar, the agency explained fully the three reasons why the methodology is invalid. And those three reasons apply equally under the earlier regulations, because the earlier regulations have exactly the same relevance.
Would it be legally open to the agency on remand to say, notwithstanding what we've said before, we think that adherence to precedent is important here?
Your Honor, I suppose if the case were remanded to Interior, it could change its mind about Vastar.
Yeah,
yes.
It could. And we
but
don't
that's,
know
that. That's, that is not possibly a ground of establishing prejudicial error. I mean, the theory that if there were remand...
It wouldn't be if the agency had dealt with Vastar. I agree.
No,
not
Your
having
Honor,
dealt with it, we don't know what they think.
No, Your Honor, the notion is that just by saying, if this went back, the agency might change its mind, therefore prejudicial error. That can't be the law. I mean, a challenger to agency action could always...
No, it's not that it might change. It's not just that. It might express itself on something that it hasn't expressed itself about, namely whether adherence to Vastar is an important value, because it didn't betray any knowledge of Vastar.
Adherence to Bayless?
I'm sorry, to Bayless.
Well, Your Honor, it's clear that the agency did not think that adherence to Bayless was a good idea, because the Bayless...
Well, if we issue an opinion that's inconsistent with a prior one, and we say, but we recognize that this is overruling a prior case, but there are reasons why we're doing so, that would be the situation you're describing. If we issue an opinion that makes no reference to the prior case, and someone comes back on rehearing and says, points that out, we might just say, oh, well, you're right, and it's more important to adhere to the prior opinion than to divert.
Your Honor, I think that this line of argument is just turning on form over substance. I mean, the premise is that the only problem with Vastar is that it did not expressly cite Bayless and then say, for the following reasons, identical reasons that we are about to give, we are overruling Bayless. I mean, that is really, I think, just a formalistic distinction. I would.
Well, we're dealing with a litigant here, a petitioner who's entitled to every consideration, including ones of form.
Your Honor, even an Indian tribe is not in a position to insist on the contrary,
the secretary as trustee is held to a standard of punctiliousness in dealing with the tribe.
Yes, Your
Honor. If it departs from form, you can do it over.
Your Honor, I still think that because this is an APA case, the tribe has to show some reason to believe it was prejudiced by what happened in the agency decision. And again, I go back to my initial point, although I know Judge Garland doesn't agree, but this is not the basis of the tribe's challenge to Vastar in before
the
court.
I think Judge Garland has a majority for that.
Well, let me just again point you to page 23 of the blue brief, where the petitioner says, not only does Vastar fail to consider the laws and regulations that govern determination of a major portion value before March 1988, it also fails to provide any reasoned explanation for departing from the Bayless precedent upholding use of the Jicarilla methodology for that period. Isn't that the argument? For that period. That's the argument you say they're not making.
Your Honor, their argument...
I mean, that's word for word the argument that they're making.
Your Honor, if that is the thrust of their argument, then I think, it's just elevating form over substance. Vastar makes it abundantly clear why it does not believe Bayless was correct in upholding the Jicarilla methodology.
It doesn't. Let me ask you just one more sort of narrower question. One of the Bayless decisions is this Union Texas one, right?
There were three.
Right.
Dugan.
Could you look at JA 139 for me?
Sure.
That's one of the, I believe that's one of the Bayless opinions. Is that right? Starts on JA 137. Is that right?
No, 137 is not one of the three decisions in the Bayless.
Oh, which one is this?
This is a memo prepared by the Mineral Management Service.
And how does
making a recommendation as to how one of the Vastar cases should be decided.
How one of the Vastar?
I believe so, because under the paragraph recommendation, right, it says we recommend denying the appeals by Union Texas, Unicon, and I believe those were lessee appellants.
Are the Vastar group?
I believe so.
Okay.
Further
thanks.
Questions?
Mr. Erbob, thank you.
Thank you.
Please, the court. Let me focus on what was before Interior when Bayless was issued. We had the Shoshone court decision. We had the Burlington Interior decision. We had the Feldmiller affidavit that was introduced by the Secretary of the Interior in the Shoshone discussing Interior's consistent interpretation of the pre-1988 MMS regulations. And then later we had a dozen cases we cite in footnote 18. And all of those go to the construction of the pre-1988 regulations. Now, everyone knew that, Your Honor, knew that that was in place when Bayless was done. And what happened was a tactical decision was made. The decision was, we can't deal with these regulations, so what we're going to do is we're going to focus on that one provision of the 1988 regulations that says if there's an express provision in the lease that is inconsistent with the 1988 regulations, then there's an inconsistency, then the lease terms trump to the extent of the inconsistency. So a tactical decision was made to...
Tactical decision by who?
Well, Your Honor, the...
You mean by the agency?
It was made by the agency with the Jicarillas. There's no dispute that the Jicarillas participated below, Your Honor, in that. They drafted portions of the decision, and there's no dispute if you look
none,
at...
None of what you're saying is in the record.
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
That they drafted the portions of the decision?
Yes, that was...
Can you tell me where that's in the record?
It's in the footnote in our brief.
No, I understand it's in the footnote. Your...
No, it... Well, it, the citations are in the footnote, Your Honor.
Okay, footnote 18 again?
No. On page 14, if you look in the, there's different counsel for the Jicarilla now than there were before. And below, the person representing the Jicarilla acknowledged that she had participated in the Interior proceeding. That's in her brief below, Your Honor, in the district court. She put in provisions in the decision about a 25%. And the 67% that's in the Bayless decision, all of that came recognizing that the Shoshone through Feldmiller, through the Burlington case, was the law. And so the tactical decision was made to rely on the 88 regulations to try to wash out all of these regulations, because they are the same as far as the requirements go, the pre-1988 regulations and the 1988 regulations. So the way to wash out all the regulations and to talk about the primacy of the lease terms is to rely on the 30 CFR 206.150, the inconsistency provision. It was a tactical decision, Your Honor, because there's no doubt that if you...
I understand the import of this.
The import is that the suggestion is that no one looked at the pre-1988 regulations, and in fact, people understood...
Are you talking about in Bayless or in Vestar? Your footnote is about Bayless, right?
In Bayless. What I'm suggesting is Bayless didn't talk about Shoshone. It didn't talk about Feldmiller or Burlington either. That is the reversal from prior agency practice with respect to the pre-1988 regulations. A tactical decision was made to try to wash out Shoshone in that kind of way. But the same thing that Your Honor talked about, if you're supposed to talk about it and announce the decision, as such as your reasoning, then the Bayless case should have talked about Shoshone. The Feldmiller affidavit is the Secretary of Interior's interpretation of what those regulations require. So it was...
So what you're saying is there would be a good attack on the Bayless case.
No, what I'm saying is Bayless isn't the first time Interior looked at this anymore. So why would you hold Vestar and say, well, Vestar's bad because it didn't talk about Bayless, when Bayless didn't talk about Shoshone?
Because Vestar's the only one under review.
Your Honor, it is the only one under review, but it was the tactical determination made to elevate the 88 regulations, to try to wash out all of that law. And then what happened was that wasn't successful. And Judge Leon was right about that. Interior was right. It's easily shown that that's not so. So then, having gotten what the district court decided, having gotten what the Interior decided, there's a change of approach. The whole new change of approach is, oh my gosh, the pre-1988 regulations, in fact, weren't discussed. The reason they weren't discussed, and I think counsel went pretty far to say this, was because they were using in the district court the 1988 regulations to try to show the inconsistency. What you need to do is get rid of all that authority if you're going to rule.
The first argument is these regulations, top to bottom, are inconsistent, and their alternative is, in any event, they weren't in effect for certain years, right? And no one's dealt with the in any event provision or portion of that argument. The district court didn't deal with it.
I think the district court did. The district talked about Shoshone and Burlington. It talked about what the requirements were.
Did it talk about the period from in question here separately?
It did in conjunction. In the opinion, it talks about Shoshone and Burlington, Judge Leon's decision.
It doesn't say anything about the specific period of time.
Yes, it does.
Well, tell me where.
JA 47, Your Honor.
I'm looking at the opinion itself. Where in the opinion?
I'm sorry. The opinion at page 11.
Page 11. The opinion starts on page 139.
Okay, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I just have the memorandum opinion.
All right. So look at that.
JA 47, Your Honor.
Okay,
in fact, Interior appears to have used the weighted volume methodology, and it addresses then the Shoshone case. And then below that, it says the regulations are consistent, the pre-88 regulations and the 88 regulations, and it cites Burlington, which is an Interior decision in 1999. And we put in the record, Your Honor, when the IBLA issued that decision, they did so on MMS's recommendation. That's what MMS's brief said. These regulations in the particulars, the three particulars, the light quality gas, the 50%, and the field and area, all of those have been the same throughout the process. And that's what we argued below. So in our briefs...
I understand that. So your argument is that the district court addressed the question. Is that what you're saying?
But the district court addressed the question.
But it's not in Vestar. It's not in the agency's decision.
That's true. It's not in the agency's decision.
Well, is that, but that's the problem, isn't it? That's a problem that we're at least talking about.
I'm trying to address the waiver question, Your Honor. And one right. deal about the waiver or forfeiture is if a technical decision is made, and I...
The waiver at what level are we talking about? Maybe I'm not... we were...
The waiver here. There's
waiver by failure to raise it in the district court or the waiver by failure to raise it in the agency?
Both.
Well, on the question about the waiver by failure to raise it in the district court, the fact that the district court addressed it doesn't indicate that it was waived.
Your Honor, if you'll just bear with me, what we had done, we, in all of our briefs, including before Interior, we would talk about Shoshone, and we would talk about the Feldmiller affidavit in Burlington. All of that was the Interior authority. And the outlier was Bayless, because it didn't address all those authorities. And in a way, to rebut that, people would never come back and say, well, Shoshone didn't say what you guys say. It didn't say Feldmiller didn't. It didn't say the 12 cases we cite in footnote 18. It never said that those didn't apply. The only thing it kept saying was, look at the 1988 regulations. There's this provision about inconsistency between lease terms and the regulation. That's what the argument was. And having made that argument below, then now the idea is, well, because Judge Leon didn't fully address the pre-88 regulation time frame, then there must be a problem. And I disagree with that.
The problem isn't that Judge Leon didn't address it. The problem is that the agency didn't address it. I mean, Judge Leon's opinion here is, I'm going to be cautious about saying irrelevant, but the problem is that we are an agency. We review de novo without regard to Judge Leon's opinion whether the agency acted arbitrarily and capriciously, correct?
That's correct.
That's our standard of review.
Yes.
So whether or not Judge Leon addressed it isn't really the question. The question is whether the agency addressed it.
Your Honor,
Your as far as I can tell, your argument seems to be that this is just so obvious that the agency didn't need to address it, that the pre 1988 were the same, and it's just so obvious.
Your Honor, it was obvious, and so that's the reason the tactical decision was made not to.
Well, when you say was made, that's in the passive tense, and that's why I was trying to figure out who was made it.
Well, Interior.
Or to put it better, it was made by who?
Interior with the Jicarilla, Your Honor.
Well, the Jicarilla certainly don't agree to that position today, and I haven't heard them. Haven't heard the words "tactical decision" come out of the Interior Department's mouth either. So, we would be inferring that. Can I ask you the part of the JA that I was asking the Interior Department about, which is the Union Texas memorandum. Which, as he explains, is a prelude to Vastar, I take it. So at page, do you have the joint appendix?
Yes, I have.
At page JA-139, the author of that memorandum in supporting MMS's position is saying that for leases prior to March 1st, 1988, the regulations state didn't require that it be more than 50%. They had this language that says to the highest price paid for a part of or a majority of the production. And that point, which is an argument about the pre-1988 regulations, is not discussed in Vastar at all. So how do we know that that's wrong, that argument is wrong about the pre-1988 regulations?
You know that from the Shoshone case, from the Feldmiller affidavit, and from the Burlington case.
None of those are cited in Vastar.
No, they're not cited in Vastar, Your Honor, and also not cited in Bayless. The agency isn't required to go in an administrative decision and sort of do all of this up in a perfect way. What they did, Your Honor, if you compare Bayless and you compare Vastar, they adopted almost all of the factual. They were trying to keep everything factually the same, but the decision changed for the reasons stated. There isn't any doubt, Your Honor, with anybody that the provisions with respect to like quality gas used in the lease, the field and area, and the 50% was, in fact, what had been used by Interior. It was an authoritative construction.
So you have no doubt that if we send it back, they'll come up the same way. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that I don't. No one knows what they do on remand, Your Honor. I'm saying that if they applied the three-part test that they had applied authoritatively, that they would reach that decision. And the reason they're being forced to focus on it now is because the argument before was always focused on the 88 regs, and now people are saying you should have really done more with respect to the earlier regs, and the facts are that they're the same. And this isn't just an attorney coming up and saying what Interior's construction was. You have the Feldmiller affidavit, which talks about how exactly they construed the pre-88 regulations. You have the Burlington case, and the Shoshone is a case where it goes through specifically the pre-88 regulations. I mean, this isn't surmise about what the three requirements are or what is required to satisfy those. That had been thoroughly litigated before. People knew that, and so if you're trying to come up with a new theory like Bayless is, the way to make that happen is to say none of that matters. And the way to say none of it matters is to say the lease terms have primacy. That's the first sentence in the order to perform that was sent to Vastar. The very first sentence talks about that Vastar reversed. You need to distance yourself from the pre-1988 regulations and the 1988 regulations. You need to try to make this into a lease term case, and that's how the Bayless case tried to do it. That's how that was tried below with the district court. Those regulations, none of them count. Why? Because of this 1988 regulation that talks about inconsistency, but at most, that could address only inconsistency with the 1988 regulations, not the earlier. That's the problem. One just can't distance themselves from what the courts and the Interior said themselves and what they testified to before the federal district court in Shoshone about what the requirements are. They said, here's how we do these pre-1988 regulations. This is how we administer those. And the district court properly said that they had consistently administered that in the way that they described in the affidavit provided to the court.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser.
May it please the court. First, I'd like to say that I believe that Judge Garland has correctly construed and articulated the arguments that we're here making today.
Well, second, we can give you Chevron deference on your own brief.
Second, I'd like to turn briefly to this issue about the pre-1988 regulations and the suggestion that there's no difference between the pre-88 and post-88. That simply isn't true. The pre-88 regulations, and they're quoted in the brief, were very general. They afforded broad discretion to the agency. Now, as a matter of practice, pre-88, the agency was using this 50% plus one measure that ultimately got graven into the 1988 regulations. But that was not an official or authoritative position of the department. All this business about the Feldmiller affidavit is that there was a case in the district court in Wyoming, that's the Shoshone case, where there was an issue about it. And Mr. Feldmiller, who was a mid-level agency person, gave an affidavit saying, this is how we do it. Now, the court simply said, all right, that's the way the agency does it. Seems okay to the court. But what happened in Bayless in the year 2000 is that the assistant secretary, who is in a position to give an authoritative position of the agency, said that the Hickory-A methodology upheld it because he ruled that it comported with the pre-88 regulations, and that to the extent it didn't comport with the post-88 regulations, primarily because of this 50% requirement. He took the position that the lease position, the lease provision, took primacy, and therefore you'd go on the lease provision rather, which the lease provision mirrors the pre-88 regs, by the way. You'd rely on that rather than the post-88 regulations. So the fact of the matter is that the authoritative statement by the agency about how, whether or not Jicarilla, the Jicarilla methodology complies with the pre-88 regulations is the statement of the Assistant Secretary in Bayless. That is an authoritative position. Even to the extent that the agency, as a matter of practice, had done it differently before, that's irrelevant because it wasn't authoritative, it wasn't in a regulation, it wasn't required. And that is why there, to get to the bottom line, if this gets back to the agency, it is by no means a foregone conclusion, as the interveners would suggest or as the government would suggest, that the agency at this point would rule that the Jicarilla methodology does not comply with the pre-88 regulations. The agency has ruled that it does comply, and those regulatory terms are very broad. And indeed, because of the fiduciary duty, it is our position that the agency is not going to be able to articulate any basis consistent with its fiduciary obligation to say that the methodology must be overturned for the pre-88 period. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Case is submitted.